And today we are looking at Dhammapada verse 306, which reads as follows. Abhutavadi nirayang upiti yo vapi katva nakaromi chaha ubhopite pecha samabhavanti Nihina kamma manuja paratha. Which means, one who says that which is not true goes to hell. As with one who, having done something, says, I didn't do it. Both of these doers of evil deeds share the same fate in the hereafter. So this verse was taught in response to the case of Sundari and the followers of other religions in the time of the Buddha. There were many other religious groups, beliefs, teachers, and with the arising of the Buddha, the other groups of religious practitioners suffered a great loss in terms of material wealth and support and fame and esteem by the general populace. As the Buddha taught, his teachings, of course, spread like wildfire and gained him great fame and renown and esteem all throughout the Indian subcontinent. The commentary says his gain materially was like a flood, the confluence of the rivers of India all coming together at once, and his fame was like the sun rising from the east. And in contrast, the fame of the followers of other religions, leaders of the other religions, the other religious teachers, was like a firefly. When the sun rises, the bright light of the firefly becomes as nothing. So they were unsurprisingly disturbed by this and became interested in trying to regain their lost fame and prosperity, which of course is not any measure of one's religious greatness, but can be seen as a sign of goodness and can be a measure of one's spiritual greatness, how much esteem one has with the general populace. But rather than trying to improve their own spiritual practice or learn something from the greatness of the Buddha, they thought of this woman, Sundari. As they said to themselves, all we need to do is destroy the ascetic Gotama's reputation. He's gained all this support and fame and esteem through the reputation that is being spread. All we have to do is destroy that. So what if we had this beautiful ascetic, female ascetic, someone who had left the home life, wasn't a Buddhist monastic, but a follower of other beliefs. What if we had her do something to destroy the Buddha's, the Gotama's reputation. So when she came to visit them, they refused to speak with her. And she paid respect to the teachers and tried conversing with the other religious people, and they just turned away and wouldn't talk to her. Again and again she tried, but they wouldn't have anything to do with her. And she finally asked, "Have I done something wrong? Have I done something to offend you? Why is no one talking to me?" And they turned, and one of them said, "Well, haven't you seen this? Gotama has brought us to great ruin. He's destroying us. And there you do nothing about it." So the manipulation starts. And she said, "Well, what would you have me do? How is this my fault?" And they said, "Well, you could do something about it." She said, "What would you have me do?" They said, "All you need to do is destroy his reputation. If you destroy the Gotama's reputation, then our religion will prosper." And she said, "How do you propose I do that?" Well, they explained her what to do. And so they conspired together in this foolproof plan to destroy the Buddha's reputation. So what she did is every evening, she would walk to Jetavana. This all took place in the area around Sawatthi, the great city in the time of the Buddha, where the Buddha spent most of his life. Jetavana, the monastery just outside of the city. She would walk from the city to Jetavana carrying flowers and scents and various accoutrements. And when people asked her where she was going, she would say, "Oh, I'm going to spend the night with Gotama in his kuti, in his room. I regularly go to spend the night with him. That's what we do." Anyone who asked, anyone who she talked to, she would eagerly relate this information to them. And then in the morning, after having spent the night in a monastery belonging to another religious group, this religious group that she was conspiring with, she would early in the morning come back to the gate of Jetavana and walk back to the city of Sawatthi. And again, whoever she met on the way would eagerly relate to them the story that she had spent the night with Gotama in his kuti. She had spent the night with the Buddha, letting him have his way with me. This is what we do. What we regularly do. And every day, day after day, she built up this rumor against the Buddha. After a few days, behind her back, this religious group that had conspired with her hired some thugs, some unprincipled men, and had them kill her and dispose of her body just outside of the Jetavana monastery where the Buddha was living, in the junk heap, the trash heap. And then they went around the city asking, "Where is Sundari? Has anyone seen Sundari?" They went to the king and told the king that Sundari is missing, this very important member of their religious school. And the king says, "Well, what do you think happened to her?" And they said, "Well, we did hear that she spent time every night with Gotama in Jetavana." And the king said, "Well, very well, let's make an investigation." And so they went and investigated, and immediately these so-called religious people went straight to the trash heap, found her body, carried it back to the palace, and proclaimed to the king that they had found this body in the trash heap outside of Jetavana in front of all the witnesses who also saw it. And the king said, "Very well, proclaim through the streets this should be brought to everyone's attention. And so they went through the streets spreading these falsehoods, what they knew to be a lie, that Samana Gotama has killed this innocent ascetic Sundari after having had his fill of sensual pleasure with her. And as a result, it became a reputation-ruining situation. So the ordinary people who had nothing to do with the situation knew about this rumor and accepted it to be true and reviled the Buddhist monks. And when they went for alms round, they were unable to receive any food. And so they went to the Buddha and told him of the situation. And the Buddha's only words were, "Very well. In that case, you recite to them this verse. Anyone who says such a thing, anyone who accuses you of such a thing, recite this verse." And then he taught them this verse. Abhutavadi nirayangupeti. One who says what is not true goes to hell. Yovapi katva na karomi chaha. As with one who, having done something, says, "I didn't do it." Ubo pite pecha samabhavanti nihina kamma manuja paratha. Both of these share the same fate in the hereafter, these evil doing people. And the result of this was quite powerful. You know, he wasn't denying it. He didn't come out right and say, "Just tell them I didn't do it." Which of course wouldn't be immediately effective. Yeah, of course, and as the verse alludes to, anyone who has been accused of something is going to say, "I didn't do it." It doesn't mean that they didn't do it just because they say they didn't. Instead, he tells them to point out the horrid nature of this situation and the terrible truth of being an evildoer, of lying, especially spreading such a malicious lie, which also includes the people who were spreading it without knowing that it was true. And this scared people. And they went back to the king, and the king heard about that the Buddha was making this bold statement, not even trying to defend himself, as though it was even below him to even consider to defend himself. He didn't even feel the need to defend himself. But he made this bold statement that anyone who does such a thing obviously is already neck deep in evil, and then to lie about it, this is the evil enough to send one to hell. And so the king thought about this and had his own investigation, and having investigated, he found the thugs who were responsible for the murder and had them confess, and found that it was indeed the followers of these other religions, were responsible for her murder and for the attack on the Buddha's reputation. And so he had these followers of the other religion, I guess at spear point, go throughout the city and confess the Buddha's innocence, confess their guilt, and then had them charged with murder and sentenced to whatever the punishment for murder was. Could be death, probably was something close to death, if not death outright. So that's our Dhammapada story. The lesson that we gain from the story, the first lesson I think that we shouldn't take lightly, is adherence to religion and faith in religion as an entity, not even talking about adherence to its teachings. We see this even in Buddhism, where people are so concerned about trying to protect the religion that they end up violating the very principles of the Buddhist teaching. There are Buddhists who in the past have gone to war, killed people in order to protect what they see as a threat to the Buddhist teaching. This has happened. It's not, from, of course, very common, because it's absurd to think that someone should go to war for Buddhism. But there are cases where people commit violence in the name of protecting Buddhism. It's just such an absurd thing. But outside of Buddhism, this is, of course, rampant. There are many religions that are quite happy and quite dedicated to protecting their religion through violent means as a matter of course. For us, as Buddhists, this is just a lesson that to not become such a person. The Buddha said, even if you get angry at someone who is criticizing the Buddha's teaching or threatening Buddhism in any way, you're obviously not following the Buddha's teaching. So as religious leaders or religious practitioners, we should not ever think about trying to protect Buddhism. We should think about protecting the Dhamma in terms of protecting our own practice of the Dhamma, never violating the practice of the Dhamma. The best way to protect the Buddha's teaching, obviously, is to practice it well. It goes without saying that if we're upset and defensive and offensive to others who are offending the Buddha's teaching, we're absolutely going against Buddhism and we're weakening it. We are the threat. The threat is from within. And the second part is following blindly those who are leaders in the religion. So protecting the religion from others is one concern that we should be very careful not to be obsessed with. But the other is to not be blinded by our faith to the point that we follow any teaching from our religion. Even the good teachings of the Buddha, even accurate, proper, perfect teachings of the Buddha can become a hindrance if you adhere to them as though they are some kind of magical spell or magical truth. So for example, the practice of meditation can be taken as a sort of, can be seen, can be taken wrongly as some sort of magical act, that by simply performing the ritual of meditation, you somehow attain enlightenment. It's not enough to have faith in the Buddha's teaching. It's not enough to follow the Buddha's teaching blindly. It's not enough to practice meditation blindly, in terms of walking back and forth and thinking, if I walk so many steps, if I practice for so many hours, somehow I will become enlightened. Every moment of meditation should be a learning experience where you use the teachings as a tool. But like the example of Sundari, where she immediately agrees to do whatever the religious teachers in her tradition tell her to do, blindly, and as a result is unable to see the horror that she's engaging in, and unable to see the evil that she's willingly participating in. Obviously, meditation is not an evil thing, but it will be still not a source of spiritual progress unless you use it for spiritual progress. You use it as a tool instead of holding it onto it like some kind of religious symbol or icon. When you walk back and forth, the spiritual progress comes from the wisdom that you gain. When you lift your foot and you're aware that the foot is lifting and you remind yourself, lifting. When you feel pain and you say to yourself, pain, this using the meditation as a tool to then understand this is pain and only pain and not me and not mine and not good and not bad, to see clearly the nature of pain, the nature of thought, the nature of emotion. This is, of course, what we do as Buddhists, but it's a reminder for us as meditators that We'll probably never be like Sundari and doing evil things in the name of Buddhism, but we can be guilty of just following the teachings blindly, hoping that somehow they will magically free us from suffering. The other lesson from the story is the Buddha's decision not to defend himself, not to say, "I didn't do it, you're lying," not to make any accusations and not to make any defense, but to instead defend the truth. What this reminds us is that enlightened people are not even, not concerned with their own well-being, not concerned with their own defense. Their first concern is not with protecting their reputation, even protecting their own physical well-being. Their first concern is protecting the truth. Their first concern is with what's right, with what's true. And this is the real lesson of this story and of this verse, is the importance and the power of truth. It shows a highness of a nobility of character when one makes this bold statement that it doesn't really matter what you say about me, but when you offend the truth, when you offend what is true and what is right, that is the true evil. That is the worst of it. It's a good lesson for us and a good reminder that what we're dedicated to here is the truth. It's why we practice mindfulness. It's one way of describing the practice of mindfulness, a cultivation of adherence and familiarity with the truth, you know, resonating with the truth, so that we're not out of harmony with the truth. When we walk and we say stepping right, stepping left, we are telling the truth. We are trying as best we can to say something that is true and to keep ourselves in line with and in touch with the truth and with reality. When the stomach rises and you say rising, that's true, it's the truth. It's nothing but the truth. There's nothing added and nothing taken away. As for the verse has only one simple lesson. The first part is simple. It just describes two types of falsehood, where you say something that didn't happen. It didn't happen, you say it happened. The Buddha didn't have anything to do with this woman Sundari. You say he committed terrible crimes, both spiritually and from a worldly perspective, in relation to this woman Sundari. And the second one is when you didn't do something and you say you did, or you did something and you say you didn't do that. So if someone did murder another person and then they say they didn't do it, both of these people are guilty of falsehood. The important lesson here is not that. The lesson here is in regards to the danger and the weight of telling lies. Because telling lies doesn't seem to most people like such a weighty crime. Ordinary people are quite comfortable with telling small lies. It's quite shocking for a Buddhist, and especially someone who has practiced mindfulness, to appreciate how quick ordinary people are to outright blatantly say this happened when it didn't, or to lie when you did something and say you didn't do it. It just seems so contrary to what is worth, what is proper, you know, from a Buddhist perspective. But the argument is that sometimes a lie is to protect a person. You lie so that they don't get worried. You lie so that they don't feel ashamed or bad about themselves. And there are some lies people would say are beneficial to others. And any lie that is unbeneficial, well, it's not like you're physically harming a person, though. No? It's not similar to hurting or killing another living being, is it? It feels like the harm is outweighed, or the harm is far less than the harm that comes from physically assaulting a person or stealing from them or that sort of thing. But from a Buddhist perspective, it is at least as weighty as the other sorts of crime, because it's a crime against the truth. you're denying this person access to the truth. You're distorting their perception of reality. You're setting them up for great calamity when they go against the truth or when they find out the truth. And you're distorting your own protection of the truth. Again, what is most important to protect and what we aspire towards in our practice of mindfulness is the truth. We protect, we guard, we seek the truth. Lying is the opposite. In the same way, in a similar way, that taking drugs and alcohol that pollute the mind or dull the mind, dull one's senses, is contrary to the cultivation of mindfulness. It's very difficult to be mindful and to see clearly when your mind is so polluted. So taking these intoxicants is antithetical to the practice, and lying is likewise antithetical. It's going the opposite direction. If the cultivation of truth is that what leads to freedom from suffering, just think the great suffering that comes from polluting your mind with lies and manipulation of others and distortion of their understanding of reality. Lying to protect someone's feelings is never going to be a wholesome or a good deed. It's never going to be something that betters them or betters yourself. It distorts reality, it complicates things. It brings us further away from the goal, which is to see clearly. It's a terrible thing. Now, of course, just as small physical acts of violence are not sure to lead one to hell, small lies are not condemning you to hell. That's not what this verse is saying. But it is saying that there is a very often underestimated weight to the utterance of falsehoods. For us as meditators, falsehood is not a real danger. Now, there have been cases where I've been lied to by meditators, but it's very, very rare. There are cases, the cases where a meditator lies to anyone, their teacher or another meditator, are pretty rare. It's not something that you have to be concerned with. Am I in danger of committing this terrible offense? But the lesson for us here that I think is very valuable for us as meditators is this idea of the truth. Obviously, we know that the core of Buddhism is the Four Noble Truths, but why it's phrased that way is quite telling. Or that it's phrased that way is quite telling, that truth is the core of Buddhism. Buddhism is not about faith, it's not about belief. It's about reality, and as such, it's about truth. It's the essence of our practice of mindfulness. And so the two lessons that we can get from this are a reminder to use the practice as a tool and to not ever cling to a teacher's word or even the Buddha's word, but instead to use it like a raft to cross a river, use it as a tool to build a house. We're constructing something here, we are building ourselves up, we are creating the faculties in our mind, the strength of mind, that will allow us to light up the world like the sun. And the other lesson is a reminder of the importance of the truth. Our own personal welfare is not important. The welfare of this body, our reputation obviously is of no concern. Worldly gain, worldly well-being, they're not wrong. It's not wrong to pursue these sorts of things in moderation. Even Buddhist monks have to find food and shelter and so on. But they are not what we seek in Buddhism. They are not our goal. They're not that which we should focus our efforts and attention on. Our attention and the whole reason for practicing mindfulness is the truth. The way we remind ourselves of what we're experiencing, telling ourselves, hey, this is this, it is what it is for the purpose of seeing it clearly and unadulterated without any extrapolation or judgment or distortion, so So we commit ourselves to the truth. Telling a lie is unthinkable for a Buddhist meditator because of our certainty in the value and importance and essential nature of the truth. So that when we're mindful, when we cultivate mindfulness as a skill and develop it through our practice, we will be able to see clearly and become one with the truth, you could say, so that we are never out of line with the truth. So, a simple teaching, but a very valuable reminder of us, to us, of the importance of truth. Thank you for listening.